This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the part of the program we call the Big Picture, where we attempt to unravel all of those data dots out there. Speaking of data dots, traditionally, the first two main shows of the year, we do predictions. And what we did last week on the show was cover the consensus forecast from various groups. That's the first thing we do in the first show. And then the second week, we give you more of our own thoughts as what we think the coming year will be. And at the end of the year, we can take a look back and say, well, how well did we do, you know, as far as these forecasts actually go? Now, to frame this, let's do a summary of what the consensus was, both from some of the outlier people and some of the mainliners. GDP growth this year will exceed 3%, 3% plus. We will not have a recession in 2018. Stock market returns will range somewhere between 2750 and 2850. And by the way, note, by the end of the week, we already passed 2750. Market returns will be between 6 to 8% for the year. And there will be, just like no recession, there will be no bear market in 2018. As far as the Federal Reserve is concerned, the Fed will raise interest rates three times this year. 10-year Treasury will hit 3% plus. Oil prices bouncing somewhere between $65 and $70 a barrel. And by the way, again, as of Friday this week, almost to $65, so we're almost there. Global growth will be stronger in 2018, and there'll be a high probability of a 10% correction this year. So if we distill all of this down, the consensus is it will be another good year for the markets and the economy. Now, Jim, that is the framework of what the gurus are saying out there. And now we come to our own personal guru here who is going to talk to us as well and see what this guru thinks. So in essence, it's going to be another good year for the economy and the markets.
So for 2018, we've marked up our GDP forecast by a few tenths of a percentage point. So we're now expecting 2.5, 2.75% GDP growth for 2018, a little less of a positive effect for 19, and even a little less for 20, so that we think the effect of the tax law will be front-end loaded and will tail off.
Okay, that's Federal Reserve's Kaplan. So anyway, what think you? That's something we didn't mention when I did the summary, too, that this euphoria, the Trump euphoria, will continue based on the new tax law.
And we're going to get into that quite a bit today and talk about what the implications are for that going into effect this year. But first thing we need to talk about is 2017. First of all, what happened in 2017 was an anomaly. You heard John Kosar in the first hour saying that, you know, in his 40 years in the business, he had never seen anything like it, because it was not only a good year, one of the best years for stock market returns that we've seen with high double digits, but it was also a year of low volatility. There was nothing more than a 2% correction. It didn't matter if it was a terrorist attack, if it was a presidential tweet, something going on in Washington or globally. The markets just seemed, I mean, last year, the best way to describe it was just like an escalator. So now let's look at 2018. It is different in so many ways. You know, if you take a look at the recession, which ended in the second quarter of 2009, we are into the ninth year of an economic recovery. It's the second longest economic recovery. And in little over a year, let's say this recovery continues into 2019, it will be the longest economic recovery since World War II. So what makes this different is we're also in a Fed rate raising cycle. And why that's important, if you take a look at the 12 recessions that we have had since World War II, 11 of those were preceded by Fed rate hikes. The one exception was the oil embargo in 1973 in the Middle East War, which precipitated a major downturn in the market. And here's also what makes 2018 unusual. We just got a major tax cut worth about $1.5 trillion. Corporate tax rates have been slashed from 35% to 21%. We haven't had anything this major since 1986. So as we go into 2018, typically you would be towards the end of a business cycle, but along comes one of the biggest tax cuts that we've seen in decades. And that changes the whole scenario for 2018. Because normally, John, we would probably be talking about the LAIs rolling over right now. The end of this cycle, the Fed would be raising interest rates. But you know what? We don't have inflation that is escalating in the way that we did from 2005 to 2007 and 8, when the price of oil went from $50 a barrel in 2005 all the way to $150 a barrel in the summer of 2008. So, number one, we are seeing major fiscal stimulus coming out at the end of a business cycle versus the beginning of one coming out of a recession. Because typically, if you take a look at the beginning of Barack Obama's presidency, George W. Bush's presidency, they began their presidency in the first year of office coming out of a recession. So, Congress was using fiscal stimulus, as Bush did, as Obama did, and at the same time, the Fed was slashing interest rates. Okay, well, Trump enters into office. We're in a late stage of a business cycle. We're not in a recession. And so Trump comes in, his major, let's say, achievement in his first year was getting this tax stimulus, which goes into effect this year. You don't normally see this, John, at the end of a business cycle. You would see it at the beginning of a cycle coming out of a recession. So that's number one. Number two, fiscal and monetary policy are out of sync. They are going in opposite directions. And you've got the government now pouring money through fiscal stimulus into the economy. And at the same time, you've got the Fed that is shrinking its balance sheet. In other words, it's removing liquidity from the market. And at the same time, you know, they're raising interest rates. And so that's going to make it more expensive to borrow. But on the other hand, it's also going to make it more, create greater incentives for banks to lend money because the yield curve should steepen, which means their profit margins should also increase. If there's anything that could end this recovery and this economic expansion and bull market, it is going to be the Fed. Because if you take a look at all of the recessions that have begun since World War II, 11 out of those 12 recessions were preceded by Fed rate hikes. So stimulus is being added and more stimulus is being talked about. One of the big policy initiatives this year of the Trump administration is a $1 trillion infrastructure program. Now, the thing about infrastructure, it takes 2 to 3 years to work its way and actually get dollars into the economy. This happened with Barack Obama's stimulus in 2009. A couple of years later, you know, there just weren't shovel-ready projects. But Trump wants to speed that up through getting rid of a lot of regulations. So what you could see is economic stimulus, which is front-loaded. We'll get more into detail here in just a moment. And that could carry us for the first couple of years, and then economic stimulus through infrastructure spending carries us the next couple of years right before a presidential election. So with all of that, fiscal stimulus, in effect, is going to extend this business cycle. We are now growing at a 3% rate for the first time in 9 years. And that is why economists are confident that GDP grows at least 3% this year. I didn't see anybody, John, on the economic front that was saying, you know, the Fed is probably more cautious. They're saying, you know, 2.5, 2.75 this year in that one clip we just played. But, you know, you're taking a look on Wall Street economists, I couldn't find one that says, hey, recession, things are going to go down. You'd be crazy to say that, given the fact that the government is going to apply $1.5 trillion in tax stimulus and cutting corporate tax rates from 35 to 21%.
I think earnings momentum is the fundamental that supports all of us being in the same consensus. That's the big fear that I think everybody has. It's the duration of this economic expansion. It's the duration of this bull market run. And when you look at the central tenets of what might cause a pullback, most of them don't exist, other than that political, geopolitical risk that might happen. And markets consistently climb walls of worry. So I'm happy to be in the consensus as long as earnings support.
That was Tom Lee from Fundstruck Global Advisors. And Jim, given the fact that the economy is picking up steam, what then about heating inflation as well? Because you have rising wages and oil prices are going up as well.
You know, John, that is probably one of the risks to consider that would prompt the Fed to get, let's say, aggressive and put us basically into a recession. Because right now, if you take a look at the futures market, they're probably likely to raise interest rates this month, then go again in March and do what they did last year. Last year, they raised rates in December, raised them in January, raised them in March, three rate hikes in a row, and then they sat back and watched for 6 or 7 months because they know if they keep doing it aggressively like they did, let's say, leading up to the 2007 and 2009 financial crisis, then what good is it doing if you're raising rates if all of a sudden you have to switch, throw the economy in recession, bear market, and then you're ending up slashing them, especially when it's taken them almost 9 years to get to, let's say, 1.5% on the Fed funds rate. So they're more likely to go slow. Now, what could put pressure on them is if inflation really starts to heat up or we see oil prices spike, and I'll have more to say about oil and the Fed here later on, but if they start getting more aggressive, that's the kind of thing that could flip this thing in the opposite direction. Like I said, one of the things that makes everything unusual right now is we've got monetary policy working against fiscal policy, and that's typically you don't want to see it. So now I want to talk about the stimulus and exactly what this may do for the economy this year. If we look at this tax bill, and you've heard all kinds of things about it, Gary Schilling in his Insight this month did a real in-depth review of the tax stimulus. 75% of it is going to corporations, which is amazing because they only pay 9% of total tax revenues. 25% is going to go to individuals. Now, at the individual level, it's a bonus for middle-class income because the impact on the wealthy is going to be very little unless you're Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, or Jeff Bezos, where the bulk of your wealth is in the corporation you founded. So if they reduce rates from 35 to 21 and you own 28% of Amazon, well, you know, guess what? That's money that goes to your bottom line. In terms of wealthy taxpayers, if you're over $1 million a year, you've got about a 3.2% tax cut, and I'm going to modify that because that depends on where you live. If you're 500 to a million, you get a 1% rate. So high tax states could see tax increases to upper income individuals, and that's mainly because they capped the property tax at $10,000, and you get the loss of the state tax deduction. So if you look at this tax bill, it is front end loaded the first 5 years. And the impact begins next month if you're a working individual when the IRS publishes their tax withholding rates. Your employers will be adjusting your weekly take-home or your bi-monthly take-home pay. However, the one thing, as I mentioned, this is front-end loaded because the benefits expire by 2025. Now, I want to talk about something specific as it relates to the stock market, and that is how this impacts corporations. Now, as they brought the rate down from 35 to 21%, they also did something else. They are going to limit interest expense as a deduction for a corporation to only 30% of EBITDA, that's earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and adjustment. And then beginning in 2021, they're going to limit it to 30% of EBIT, which is earnings before interest and taxes. Now, why that's important is right now when a corporation pays tax on earnings and then they send it to you as a dividend, that dividend they send to you is not tax deductible. However, when they pay interest on debt, let's say they issue corporate bonds, they pay the bondholders interest, that is 100% deductible. Now, what we saw in this economic recovery is we saw a lot of tax and interest rate arbitrage. I can remember very clearly in 2014, a lot of companies from Intel to Apple to Amazon to other corporations issued debt at a lower rate. And the example I always use is Intel because it illustrates it perfectly. They issued a 5-year bond at 1.6% interest rate. They raised $5 billion. They turned around, used that $5 billion to buy stock. Their stock at that time was paying over 4.25%. So the interest they borrowed was deductible where the dividend they retired was not. And so this is going to change the equity markets, because now is going to be more advantageous for companies to raise money in the equity markets versus the debt markets. And of course, what that translates to is more stock coming into the market, because debt is no longer going to be as favorably recognized under the tax law. So that was a major, major change. But the result of this tax bill is you are going to see deficits are going to start rising again. And we are moving more towards that $1 trillion mark you are likely to see, as we were coming out of the recession when we had $1 trillion deficits for the first term of Obama's office. So we are heading back in that direction as a result of the tax bill, and also as a result of entitlements increasing as more and more boomers head into retirement, drawing on the Social Security Trust Fund and Medicare. And that is going to lead to a entitlement crisis in the beginning of the next decade.
So outside of cutting taxes for corporations to increase profits, what about benefits to the consumer? Because as you pointed out, only about 25% of the benefits here are going to consumers, 75% going to corporations.
Well, so far, there's been over 130 major Fortune 500 S&P companies announcing major employee bonuses. Also, companies are coming out saying they're raising wages for employees, everyone from Walmart to Wells Fargo. And a lot of other companies are coming out saying, hey, we're going to build new plants. And this is almost happening on a weekly basis, which was what they were hoping this tax law would do. They wanted to kind of speed up economic growth, which we're moving from a 2% rate where we've been at for 8 years. We are now cruising at a 3% rate, and wages are going up. Plus, we're also looking, John, it's not just the tax increases. We're also looking at two more stimulus measures coming from government working their way into the economy. Number one, they just passed a budget bill for 2018 that increases military spending to $700 billion. And right now, on the front plate of the government, or at least the Trump administration's agenda, is a $1 trillion infrastructure spending bill. And John, you know, this is an election year, and there's nothing more that a congressman or a senator wants to do in election year is come back to his district and say, hey, look at the pork, or look at the spending programs I brought into our district to create jobs. And so there might be some bipartisan approach for spending money, and especially $1 trillion.
So now that we know that we have rising wages, we've got a faster growing economy, rising oil prices and commodity prices, what does this portend for what you think the Fed is going to do, how they're going to try to do what they're going to do and justify it?
Well, I mean, that is the one big wild card, in my opinion. I mean, there are a number of wild cards out there, and we'll get to them in just a moment. But the one that really stands out is a policy mistake by the Fed. And one of them would be if inflation started to heat up, especially with rising oil prices. But, John, I think there's going to be a lot more caution. At least I've seen it over the last 2 or 3 years, and especially last year. The one thing that the Fed would have a hard time being aggressive is inflation is very low. Secondly, they're well aware when they announce taper, the last thing they would want is a taper tantrum right now in the bond market. Can you imagine, like, for example, in 2013, when we went from 1.5% on the 10-year treasury to 3% in a matter of 6 months, that's the last thing that the Fed would want to do, is create financial turmoil. The other thing that we have going, even though the Fed is removing liquidity, the ECB and the Bank of Japan are still in a quantitative easing mode. So that money is coming into the market. It's creating liquidity. And a lot of that liquidity is making its way back to the U.S. market, putting a lid on upward movement of interest rates, because the spread between U.S. treasuries and sovereign debt in Europe and Japan is as wide as the Grand Canyon. The other thing, and this is something that does concern the Fed, is the danger of market disruptions, because you have investors chasing yield. You also have investors chasing risk. And I'm talking about hedge funds, institutions, because the individual investor is primarily out of this market. So there's always that. And then there's also the growing reality that the government has $21 trillion in debt. This isn't like when Obama took office when we only had $10 trillion, or when Bush took office when we only had $5 trillion. We're sitting on $21 trillion of debt and soon to be experiencing $1 trillion deficits.
So what does this mean for the market? We have strong economic growth, and the Fed's policies pretty much want to go slow.
You know, if you take a look at the impact of a 21% corporate tax rate and a 35% tax rate, this could add, and I've seen a number of studies, this could add $11 to $18 to earnings per share for the S&P 500 companies. The market could be, in my opinion, underestimating the impact of those earnings and the result of those tax cuts. We could see, especially after first quarter or Q1 earnings, and we get more into fourth quarter earnings, you start to see companies and analysts start upward revising their earnings estimates, and that can change things dramatically. The other thing also that's going that we haven't seen is global economies are in sync now. In other words, we're seeing growth across all the major economies around the globe. So that's also going to help earnings, especially for corporations. And as long as the dollar doesn't rise precipitously with these Fed rate hikes, because once again, the spreads between here and overseas are very, very wide. So these tax cuts could drive earnings for the next 2 years at double-digit gains. I mean, if you have a growing economy, the faster the economy grows, that's greater earnings, and especially if it's global, not just here in the U.S. Of course, the risk is always greater for markets when there is risk of a recession. And that's the one good thing as we head into 2018 with this stimulus. There's no signs of any recession this year. Now, that could change in the second half depending on what the Fed does. So once again, what is going on right now is we've got massive fiscal stimulus at the same time the Fed is raising interest rates. As long as those rate hikes are moderate, slow in pace, this could be another good year. But if they start switching, let's say this market just balloons in the first half of the year, inflation heats up, we're at $70, $80 oil prices, that environment could change. But right now, we've got the ECB, the Bank of Japan, is still flooding the markets with money, and that is definitely a stimulus to the economy. And plus, there may be more stimulus in the works. We don't know how this is going to go. I mean, it took us a whole year to get to the tax cuts. So what happens with infrastructure? That's another thing, too. It may take us a whole year to get there, although I think they would want to get something done in an election year so they can go home and say, look, see what I did? Look at the jobs and the money I'm bringing into the district. So markets may be underestimating the benefits of these corporate tax cuts. And the other thing too, it makes the U.S. more competitive. So you can see greater upside than what the market is talking about. A good example is the ranges for the S&P are 2750 to 2850. We've already surpassed 2750 in the first 2 weeks of the year. And if we keep going, you know, the day we're doing this broadcast, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up over 228 points. The S&P is up almost 19 points. I mean, we've got gains 4%, 5%, and 6% in just the first 2 weeks of the year. So this is something that can change the whole equation in how people view the markets. And there's nothing that makes the markets happier when you start having corporate CEOs saying, hey, you know, we thought we were going to earn a dollar this year. Given our tax cuts, we're raising that to $1.20. Or you start seeing Wall Street analysts upgrade their earnings forecast as we proceed into the year after first quarter and second quarter. That could happen. So a lot of this is going to depend on corporations delivering earnings and the Fed maintaining a sort of neutral, sort of a go slow pace and refraining from what I call hawkish comments. You know, the last thing the market wants to do is just you have Fed governors going out saying, you know what, I think we need to raise 4 or 5 times. I'm worried about inflation. Those are the kind of things that shake confidence in market. So, you know, overall, though, John, as we take a look at this environment and just kind of look at where this market is going and how we've been on this sort of escalator since the elections of 2016, is the markets at this time could be underestimating. So look for some upside surprises with analyst estimates coming up and saying we're going to revise this up or companies doing the same. So we could see greater upside than is expected. As we talked about last week, the consensus was 2750 to 2850. And here we are on this Friday. We're almost at 2,800 already, and this is only the second week of the year. So this is something that, you know, one of our themes this year is expect the unexpected, either in a fast and furious correction that could be as much as 10%, which we haven't seen since 2016, or we see some kind of events on the upside. In other words, a melt up before the meltdown.
You know, is there anything that really just strikes you about this run-up compared to things you've seen in the past based on your experience?
Very much so. And just as John Kosar and I were talking about in the first hour, where he's never seen anything like this in his 40 years, I think the one thing that really stands out in this market since 2009 is the absence of public participation. I mean, if you take a look at the fund flows, where money's going, about 10% is going into stocks, 90% is going into bonds, which is interesting because we are now in a Fed rate raising cycle. And we know in the end that this is not good for bonds. But if you look at what has happened to this economy and this recovery, first of all, U.S. GDP increased by almost $3 trillion. That's almost the size of, let's say, Germany's economy. And next to that, the U.S. share of global GDP also increased at the same time. We're looking at the lowest unemployment rate in nearly 17 years, and not to mention the fact, and this has a lot to do with real estate, household net worth is up almost 168%. Now, most of that has come from housing. Now, granted, most people that are working are putting money away in a 401k plan, a 403b, or 457 plan, and may have some money in equities, but a good portion of that has come from the upward depreciation that we've seen in real estate. What makes this outstanding, John, that only 10% is going into, let's say, stocks versus 90% in bonds, is total return on equities has been over 370%. And the other thing is, and we'll see here in fund flows here in just a minute, is the U.S. equity market has outperformed all the major market indexes around the globe since 2009. So if you take a look at this, this is probably the most hated bull market in history.
We still see most investors underinvested. We see most investors are sitting with the duration of their liabilities longer than the duration of their assets. So there's a lot of, there's quite a bit of purchasing power, even at these levels, to keep the markets stable. This is why we're still quite bullish on equities at these levels. This is another reason why we think we're going to see higher interest rates, but not as high as some people may fear. And as you said, inflation is muted, and we don't see at this time inflation changing. Now, the two keys for inflation is going to be dominated by, are we at a point in time where wages now are going to start increasing dramatically? We're seeing that in the high-end area, especially in the programming and our engineer types. We're seeing very large wage growth, and we're seeing this throughout the country. The key for me is paying attention to China. If China, in the next 5 years, really aggressively does the reforms that they talk about, what the reforms mean to me is they're going to take out the excess capacity. And China has been a exporter of deflation. Could China become something different? And that will change the whole metrics of global inflation.
The voice of Larry Fink from BlackRock. And Jim, if individuals aren't participating here, what's driving this market?
Basically, John, what's driven this market is corporate buybacks, which have averaged $500 billion a year. That's $500 billion in central bank buybacks. And that is so much larger. Even if individuals were participating as they normally have, let's say, in previous bull markets, it is dwarfed by the buying power of major corporations. Because, I mean, if we take a look at where individual investors have put their money, it pales in comparison to corporate buybacks. Since 2009, $185 billion has come out of the stock market. Individual investors have poured $738 billion into international equities, $259 billion into emerging market equities, but here's the bulk of it, $1.8 trillion into bond funds. When you think about, we've had over $4 trillion in corporate buybacks. So the main driver of this market has been corporations, and that probably will continue and get even stronger now, especially if some of that money comes back with repatriation. But I think so far, as you take a look at what is driving this market, it is going to continue along with those corporate inflows. But the thing that stands out is the individual investor is not in this market in the way they've participated in previous bull markets. I think two bear markets in 2000 and 2007 kind of soured a whole generation on equities. So that is something that I think if you look at this market, the one thing that really stands out is lack of participation by individual investors.
So looking at it from the point of view of the stock market, what are probabilities this year?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at this, strong earnings per share growth, as I mentioned earlier, estimates are that as a result of tax cuts, you could see anywhere from $11 to $17, $18 added to earnings per share the next couple of years. Another thing that I think that you have to see is there's been a complete regime shift in Washington. Deregulation, tax cuts, more favorable business environment. I mean, John, they were trying to get drilling in Anwar for three decades. It's now going to be done. We spent almost an entire decade trying to get the Keystone Pipeline. That's now in place. So the regulatory environment and business environment in Washington has changed. The other thing, too, the major bear markets that we've seen, and especially like the one that we saw in 2007, was a recession. So during a recession, bear markets become more severe. Right now, there's just a very, very low probability of a recession this year. The other thing, as I just mentioned, negative sentiment by investors. Usually bear markets end or begin when there's widespread euphoria, not just by individual investors, but also by institutions. The other thing is you got to factor in these tax rates. If tax rates drop from 35 to 21, imagine what that's doing for corporate cash flow. Imagine what, for example, let's say that if you were in an individual tax bracket of 35%, and we do have a 35% tax bracket, and your tax bracket was dropped from 35 to, let's say, 21 or 22, think of what that would do to your own take-home earnings. So that's going to be positive. The other thing is interest rates have been gradual. Unlike, let's say, the 2004 period to the 2007 period, where every single FOMC meeting, the Fed was raising interest rates, or like, for example, in 1999, where the Fed was raising rates aggressively, not just a quarter point, they were doing it 50 basis points at a time. That's not what we're doing now or what we've seen. The other thing also is modest wage increases.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, Jim, they're talking about more stimulus.
And that's one of the big things on the agenda. But John, as you know, even if they were talking about infrastructure spending, it's going to be 2 to 3 years before it actually works its way to the economy because of regulations and all those things, although the Trump administration is speeding that up. So what you could have is a couple of years where the tax stimulus, which is front-end loaded, drives the economy, and then all of a sudden you have infrastructure spending kicking in as we move into a presidential election year in 2020. So the key, whether we get that far, is really going to depend on the Federal Reserve. Like I said, this is so unusual in history that you have monetary policy going in the opposite direction of fiscal policy. That's number one. And normally, number two is seeing fiscal policy being applied at the end of a business cycle versus the beginning of a business cycle. And then I think another key thing, unlike 2000 where we had imbalances in the technology market or 2007 with real estate, at this time, and I put a caveat there, at this time, we have no imbalances like we did in 2000 and 2007. So right now, believe it or not, the best place to be is in the U.S. Number one, we've been preeminent since 2009, thanks to technological innovation, a flexible labor market. We have also a better regulatory environment than what you find in Europe. We have higher interest rates. So if you're a foreign investor, you're in Europe, you're an institution, or you're in Japan, you're looking at negative rates on short term, where here they're going to be over 2% this year, and maybe even up to 3%. So we have higher interest rates, and now with corporate tax rates at 21%, the U.S. has one of the lowest tax rates in the developed countries.
Well, this always brings me to my sort of, question. What are the risks that no one sees that could actually derail everything we're talking about right now? Black swans, other events?
You know, once again, my number one risk is a policy mistake at the Fed. Once again, if you take a look at all these recessions and the severe bear markets, they've all been preceded by a Fed rate raising cycle. They were caused by the Fed. We haven't seen much of an impact in the markets is the Fed began with interest rates at zero. So we're only at 1.5 on a Fed funds rate. Typically in the past, we've gotten up to 5% and 6% Fed funds rate, but we started at a higher base. In 2004, Greenspan started at 1%. In 1999, he started at 3%. We're starting at zero, so you haven't seen as much of an impact. At some point, however, with this massive amount of debt at the corporate level, the government level, the consumer level, at some point, higher interest rates are going to start having an impact. The other thing is the Fed is shrinking its balance sheet. By the end of the second quarter, they'll be shrinking their balance sheet by $30 billion a month. That's $30 billion that's not going to be in the market buying treasuries. What is keeping a cap on treasuries right now is lower interest rates and negative rates overseas, and that money's finding its way here. Now, that could reverse because right now, the ECB and the Bank of Japan are still flooding the markets with liquidity. So, number one risk, John, is higher inflation in the Fed, and that could come if oil prices spike. And the one problem I see with that is the Fed can't do anything to the oil markets. They can't stimulate oil demand. The only thing they could do is just kill the economy with a recession. That's about the only thing that would drop oil prices down with demand going down. And really, does the Fed really want to do that? If it's mainly oil, they can go back and say, look, we can't control what's happening to oil right now. That's a supply or that's an OPEC production cut problem. And besides, if oil prices start to rise in the $70 range or 75 or spike like John Kosar and I were talking about in the first hour, you can always see American shale ramp up production. So the top number one risk, in my opinion, is a policy mistake, because really what they're trying to do, they're trying to normalize interest rates, but they have to be thinking, hey, but in the process of normalizing, we may create the very problem we're trying to normalize rates for, and that's prepare for the next recession when in fact they cause it.
You know, the big one now, as you see things with Iran and with North Korea, what about geopolitical risk?
You know, those are, John, the things that are so hard to predict. I mean, the Fed, a little bit easier to monitor because they have FOMC meetings, they have Fed's chairman going out and giving speeches, so you kind of know where their thinking's going. You know, how do you predict what North Korea is going to do or what the Middle East is going to do? So those are the things, you know, the outbreak of a conflict in the Middle East like we had in 1973, another major terrorist events or a series of terrorist events. Those are the things, John, you just simply, you can't really predict. But they're out there and we see them on the evening news. Another one that you can't predict, and this is a big one, and that's cyber attacks. I mean, if you just take a look at all the things that have happened in the last couple of years. And the other thing too, as we move more and more to the cloud and run everything in the cloud, we become more vulnerable. And so this is something that, you know, we have to monitor. But, you know, how do you predict it? I mean, just take a look at last year. You had 145 million people who had their social security data stolen from Equifax. Verizon announced the scale of Yahoo's hack, which took over 3 billion accounts. You've got WikiLeaks. You've got Uber revealed that, you know, they had 67 million Uber users had their data taken. So cyber attacks becomes increasingly important. It was interesting in the interview I did last August on the author with the mandibles. Part of her fictional plot is a major dark age for about 2 or 3 years globally because of a massive cyber attack. So cyber attacks are on the rise, but how do you predict it? Number three, sky-high debt levels. We have record margin debt, record corporate debt, record sovereign debt. And when you have the Fed raising interest rates, somebody somewhere is going to be on the wrong side of a trade. I can tell you the number of hedge funds that have blown up their investors by taking on undue risk, by leveraging up their trades, in blowing out the market. How many times have we read in the papers a major hedge fund blows up in because they take a one-way bet, they're going all in, they leverage up and blow out their investors. And the likelihood of that happening again is very high with the leverage that's in the market right now and the Fed raising interest rates. The other thing too, very unpredictable. China is scaling back on credit. So what's the risk of a Chinese slowdown and it goes worse than expected? And of course, number five is a dysfunctional Washington. You have both political parties. John, I don't know about you, but this is probably the nastiest I have seen Washington in my entire career. I mean, if you just take a look at the last 8 or 9 years, it has gotten ugly between both political parties, and they're basically at war with each other. It's a very toxic environment. I'm basically surprised they even got a tax bill. However, that being said, as long as the economy remains strong, and it looks like that economic growth is picking up, it is more likely to be able to absorb any of these kind of black swans or rogue waves. So anything that could happen, if an event like that happens, it's more likely to be a correction than a bear market. The greatest risk for a bear market is in a recession. And John, right now with this kind of tax stimulus and more on the books being talked about in Washington, I just don't see a recession this year, given what just happened in December with this tax bill.
Well, the thing we can watch, at least with a certain level of reliability, is the Fed, because they tend to tell us what they're going to do ahead of time. So you can anticipate that as opposed to some of these unanticipable things. So as you look at all of this, your conclusions on all of it.
You know, summing it up, John, another good year for the economy and the markets as a result of this tax stimulus, and we may be even getting more. But I don't think the consensus, as we've talked about, is likely. Once again, the consensus is 2750 to 2850 on the S&P. We're almost at 2800 in the second week of the year. So either we get into a melt-up, and that is very likely. In other words, 2018 can be a first half and second half story. We could melt up and just blow through some of these numbers that are projected much higher than anybody is anticipated in the first half of the year. But I just don't think it's going to be a consensus year. We either melt up or something happens we don't expect all of a sudden out of the blue. Like, let's say we melt up going into the first half of the year, and this summer the Fed gets aggressive, oil prices get higher, and all of a sudden they get more aggressive on interest rates, and we get a major 10% correction in the market before maybe, let's say, finishing out the year on a positive side. So I just don't think this is going to be an escalator year. It may be in the first half, but somewhere along the road, we're going to have some hiccups here in some things. I just don't see an escalator year with 2% market corrections and low volatility. I mean, not to say it can't happen. I mean, what happened last year is the first time I've seen anything like that in my lifetime. So this market right now has been unstoppable, but no sign of a turn at the moment. The fundamentals are kicking in. They're looking stronger with this stimulus. And technically speaking, as all my technicians will tell you, there is nothing. You heard John talk about his sort of alert status in terms of possible correction. There's nothing out there right now.
If we then look at where the market is right now and everything we've discussed so far, if you're in the market, or maybe you've been out of the market for a while and you're thinking of doing something, what plan of action should you follow?
I mean, if you're in the market, you know, just hopefully you're not 100% in stocks. You know, hopefully you've done some diversification and reallocation to your portfolio. I think being 100% invested in the market is very unwise. But, you know, you stay the course, because let's say the market goes up 10, 15, 20% in the first half of the year and we correct 10%, you're still going to be okay. Because as long as the Fed doesn't get aggressive, as long as the economy continues to grow, the risk of a severe bear market in recession are negligible. However, if you've been out of stocks and you're just thinking of getting in now, my word of advice, you better be careful, because I think this is the year you take a rifle approach. You look for special situations in undervalued stocks or stocks that have gotten beat up, or special sectors within the market. You know, we're keen on energy, materials, financials, and consumer discretionary, because Energy, obviously, benefiting from rising oil prices, materials from rising commodity prices, increased economic growth, financials because an increase in the yield spread as the Fed raises interest rates, that increases bank margins, and consumer discretionary because this tax bill is going to put money in consumers' pocketbooks beginning next month when withholding tables will be adjusted by employers.
And we mustn't forget bonds in this whole equation.
I think bonds, you have to take a special approach, as Rob Bernard and I talked about in hour one. You know, we like the barbell approach, interest rate floaters in short-term debt, especially with the Fed raising interest rates. But overall, John, this is a year that stocks are going to outperform bonds.
And as we bring this down to a distilled conclusion, what would you say?
Well, expect the unexpected. But overall, we're still dancing, just a little closer to the door.
Well, Jim, in the weeks to come, it seems like we're going to continue at this 3% GDP growth, which is a stark change from what we saw in the years following the 2007-2008 crash. In the immediate weeks, we have, what, reports coming back, other things?
Well, we're going to be getting into fourth quarter earnings season. That's going to start here in the next couple of weeks. We've got the Fed meeting coming up, and so everybody's going to look for, hey, are they changing their tune? They'll probably just say, hey, you know, we're still on target. We plan on raising three times. So we've got corporate earnings. We've got Fed meeting. We've got a budget shutdown battle coming up that could create a little conflict in the markets. But overall, John, that's pretty much what we're going to be talking about in the weeks and months ahead. It'll be interesting once they start adjusting payrolls beginning in February, what happens with consumer discretionary retail spending. We're going to watch and see if there's a pickup there. We're also going to be watching for more companies. Right now, 130 have announced either pay increases, bonuses, or they're going to bring and invest in new plants here to see if we see a continuation of that trend. And so those are the things we're going to be watching on. And, you know, once again, the one thing that we can watch is what the Fed is doing. You know, cyber attacks, what goes on in the Middle East or something, those things are hard to predict. But right now, we're still dancing, just a little closer to the door. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.